the Republicans to wake up is... The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
I am humbled by the support of many great listeners of this program. Today we thank Janet Price, Mark Brodsky, Mark Dennis, and Hawaii's Russ Archibald. If you can help and you're able, just log on to peterbcollins.com. On the right-hand side, there's a little link that says you can help. And our voluntary subscriptions start as low as $5 a month. Near the end of this podcast, Will Durst returns with his weekly rant, this time about the overturning of California's Proposition 8, which banned gay marriage. But first, a tale of international intrigue and lots of duplicity. And it starts... at the zoo.
The monkeys stand for honesty, giraffes are insincere, and the elephants are kindly, but they're dumb.
Especially the Republicans.
Orangutans are skeptical of changes in their cages.
And they hurl fecal matter, too.
Is very fond of rum. Zebras are reactionaries. Antelopes are missionaries. Pigeons blocked in secrecy. And hamsters turn on frequently. What the gas you got to come and see at the zoo.
Going way back to bookends from Simon and Garfunkel, that's At the Zoo. And returning to our program today is my friend and colleague and the author of a second book about critters. This one is Forbidden Creatures, Inside the World of Animal Smuggling and Exotic Pets. Peter Laufer returns to our program. Hey, Peter.
It's great to be here, Peter, with you.
Now, you mentioned in the book that one of your first exposures was at the old Fleischacker Zoo here in San Francisco.
Yeah, I can remember being a grammar school kid, and if you remember that zoo, one of the things, speaking of elephants, that was the most fun was the elephant key, early audio touring. Do you remember that?
And you would buy at the Cincinnati Zoo, we had the same exact thing, the plastic key in the shape of an elephant.
Buy this key, and then you go up to the cage.
The squawk box.
And turn it, and some guy...
A professional announcer would tell you.
That's right. We'll tell you something about this animal, and it must have been fun for the guy who did that announcing, just as it was for you that time when you showed up at the Atlanta airport and had forgotten that you did the announcements for the train, and it was telling you what stop to get off, and it was you telling you.
Yeah, happened in Miami, too.
That's great.
Well, Peter, this is a fascinating book, and nominally it's about exotic animals claimed as pets or domesticated or at least imprisoned by human captors, but it's really about you. And that's the part I find fascinating.
It's now, funny that you say that. Excuse me for interrupting you because I thought you were going...
Oh, it's my show. You're going to have to wait.
Okay. All right. It is your show.
No, go ahead.
No, I thought you were going to say what my conceit is, that it's really about these people and the psychology of the people who choose to have these pets that are different than usual pets, the dog that you have here in the studio.
Right. They're just devices, though. And through it comes your own... conflicted feelings about pets in captivity. And that's what I find fascinating, and we'll get there in a moment.
Okay.
Peter Laufer and I have worked together for many years and known each other for 15 or 18 years. He worked in the radio business for ages,
He took me on junkets to Berlin and Amsterdam, where he had gigs and hired me as a consultant. We had a great time overseas. He's published now 18?
Something like that.
Books?
Yeah.
Inside Talk Radio was the one I like best because there was something about me in
there. There was a chapter about you in it, and it's available if your listeners want to read about you.
Inside Talk Radio, still available at Amazon somewhere?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And a few years ago, he did a great job covering those who refused to serve in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And it was on that book tour that a reader, or at least someone who attended a bookstore event, said, "What are you going to write about next?" And that's when you threw out the offhand line, "Butterflies," or something like that. Then you published The Exotic World of Butterflies.
Dangerous World of Butterflies. Yes.
And that was fascinating. It exposed me to a whole world that I had never seen. And now I have the new book, and you have magically morphed from a human to a chair. Because you are, let me get it right here, the incoming James N. Wallace Chair in Journalism at the University of Oregon School of Journalism and Communication. Congratulations.
Thank you so much. It's going to be a lot of fun. I look forward to you coming up to Eugene and guest lecturing, Peter.
Well, and I just want to say, we'll get into the book in a moment, but your students are going to be very fortunate because I know that every day when you come in to lecture, it's going to be interesting, it's going to be colorful. You're going to engage them on a number of levels. And I'm really excited that you're going to be able to take your 30 or 40 years, who's counting, of experience as a journalist and a radio guy, and pass that to a whole new generation who are using different tools, or at least different techniques and different media platforms. And so I think this is going to be a rich experience for you, as well as your students, and I can just imagine the exchanges that are going to occur.
Well, it's really gracious of you to say that. When you started with that litany, I was waiting for the punchline where you were going to slap me sideways.
No. And Peter has filed dispatches for my radio shows from Cairo, from Berlin, from exotic places all over the world. And the Laufer scene setter is something that I really prize. Because when you look out the window and describe it, you see more than many people do, or at least you're able to summon the words to paint that picture.
Well, thank you for that, Peter. And I am looking forward to going up to Oregon. The idea of being able to warp the minds of the next generation in the context of news and media is really a privilege.
Mm-hmm.
I'm excited and thrilled.
Yeah. So you mentioned that my little dog is here, and for the benefit of my listeners, I want to mention that we have a new puppy, and this is Rosie, and she is a little exotic, but was born and bred in captivity, I have to say, so I won't fall afoul of your
No, and I'm not necessarily even against some of these exotics, as you know from the book, but this thing really is exotic. You said 5 pounds, and mm-hmm. the fur, when I just came in and met your dog and
Rosie, mm-hmm.
and it reminded me of the newborn serval that I petted mm-hmm. in Macon, Missouri at an exotic pet auction. Mm-hmm. But this thing's a dog.
It is, yes. And for the benefit of my listeners, Rosie is our new dog, and Rocky was the dog before that. And I did put up a blog post, and some people have seen it, but Rocky died in June.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And it was a real setback, Peter.
Yeah.
And I wanted to explain this as a way of talking about the way people relate to pets. Because we had dogs when I was growing up, and I loved them. We had a girl named Fred, and she was a charmer. And then, as an adult, I didn't have pets for a long, long time. Then my brother moved to Japan, asked me to take care of his dog for 6 months. And I re-entered the world of connection with animals. And I remember driving home one day with my brother's dog, Sumi, sitting on the console in the middle of the car, licking my ear. And I looked around, and the windows had paw prints, and, you know, there's fur and little bits of Cheerios and stuff around. And I said, wow, I'm one of them.
Uh-huh.
I'm a dog person. And when Rocky died, I have to say I really felt it because I loved the fun and the frolic, but I didn't realize how deep that connection had become until we lost him. And so we were kind of in the wilderness, and now Rosie has just been with us for a couple of weeks, and it kind of renews my connection and my appreciation for animals of all kinds. And so I say that as a way of saying that I think I understand the attraction that many of the people you write about in the book initially have to an exotic creature. And whether it was a visit to a zoo or a movie that they saw, somehow they have created a vision or an image for themselves that is not complete without the pet that they fantasize about or that they have a quest for. And yet, time and time again, you meet people who go to an extreme, who put their lives at risk to live with a large, exotic, formerly wild animal. And throughout the book, you keep asking why. And you ask many of the experts and other people you meet why. And that, to me, is the central thread of your book, is that you're trying to come to grips with this as an animal-loving, near-vegan, who carves the family turkey. You mentioned that at least twice in the book every year.
That's right.
And so it's really an exploration of your ambivalence about the way humans treat animals.
My ambivalence, I guess, but also my curiosity. And I'm not sure it's as benign with many of these people as you suggest. I'm not sure it is that same sense of bonding and then ultimately, unfortunately, loss that you felt with Rocky. I am, in fact, quite convinced that for many of these people, it's a sense of exerting power, of satisfying ego, of seeking to play with danger, something very different than the kind of relationship that you're talking about, interspecies friendship. Although, certainly, I met with some people who are experiencing that and just happen to like a cat that is 100 times bigger than my cat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the other thing that occurred to me is that many of the people who you profile in the book, and you've traveled all over the U.S., visiting these sanctuaries and refuges and private zoos that allow the public to come in. And in each case, you know, it reminded me of the people who crusade against pornography, that they want to make sure that we collect all this stuff and keep it in a safe place where nobody else can see it. And the rationalizations that people verbalize to you about why they do this, and you present conflicts from one person to another, and not just from the extremes of PETA to a real exploiter of animals, but people who you would think have some common thinking and common feelings, who have strong antipathies for one another. So it's fascinating, and beneath it all are people who often feel superior to other people because of what they think their personal mission is relative to these exotic animals.
Yeah, and I think you really did find a point there that is worth criticizing, and that is those who are running sanctuaries and are quite holier than thou about the work that they're doing to protect the animals from being exploited by those who would keep them as pets. And in fact, these people are engaging in the same kind of activity. I'm thinking in particular of the woman who now has custody of the monkey that was smuggled in from Thailand. And she seems like a wonderful woman doing great work, but she is now playing with that monkey that was taken away from the smuggler who was playing with that monkey.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, most of these people seem to have very positive initial ideals, but they become rationalizers, particularly as these pets, these quote-unquote pets, these large exotic animals that, as you point out, you can't breed the wild out of them. You can put them in captivity, but particularly at feeding time, a big cat, a big monkey or related species, they become a major risk.
And particularly after adolescence.
Mm-hmm.
And the combination of being hungry and being post-adolescent exerts something weird in all of us, including you and me, when that was our status.
Yeah. Well, and toward the end of the book is a fairly recent story of a woman who kept a bear
in a
cage in Pennsylvania. And she went in to clean the cage, as she had done, a neighbor or maybe it was her husband said, she'd done it 1,000 times. But on the 1,001st time, the bear didn't take the bait to move out of the way so she could clean the cage, and the bear came after the keeper.
And she became the bait, and he killed her in very short order in front of her children, who happened to be in the backyard watching.
Yeah. Mm. Boy. So what compelled you to pursue this? I know that when you wrote The Dangerous World of Butterflies, it introduced you to a world of people who are trafficking in species that are endangered and therefore illegal. And you met a fish and game officer who investigates these cases. Did some of these leads surface in the butterfly phase?
Oh, no question about it. And The Dangerous World of Butterflies led directly to this book. And I have to tell you, Peter, that I'm in the middle of the third book. It's become a trilogy. The working title of the third book, I'm fighting a bit with my editor, and I hope I win, is No Animals Were Harmed During the Writing of This Book. Mm-hmm. And they are leading one to the next. And the butterfly book introduced me to the Fish and Wildlife Special Agent Ed Newcomer, who's become a friend and does remarkable work, and a whole cast of other characters that made me realize that I can stay away from my usual wars and pestilence work for a while longer and hang out with animals and the weird people that engage with them, to discover this world of so-called exotic pets, which happened during the research for the butterfly book, mandated that for me that I learn about these people. Much more interesting to me than some of the stories, as fascinating as they are, about the problems of smuggling. That's pretty well documented, and I go over that at the beginning of the book. But who these people are and what they're doing, that monkey we were just talking about, smuggled in from Thailand, smuggled in by a mother-daughter team because the mother wanted the daughter to have a monkey, and they feigned the daughter's pregnancy and then dosed the monkey with sedatives and managed. Not only is that in itself fascinating, and of course, if you care about animals, you have to worry about the monkey being sedated for that length of time, but in this post-September 11th world, politics is everywhere. I don't get away from the wars and pestilence, of course, and in this post-September 11th world, they managed to go out of Bangkok, transfer in Korea, in Seoul, I think it was, transfer in Hong Kong, get into LAX, get into this country with no problem, transfer again and get up to Spokane, and only get busted because she paraded around a shopping center in Spokane saying, look at the monkey I smuggled in.
Well, obviously, the theatrics of airport security have fooled you.
I guess. But consequently, this world does fascinate me. And the third book that I'm working on now deals with the point in the continuum where animal use becomes animal abuse.
Mm-hmm. And just a quick side note, you're not a tabloid guy, because the reference to Sylvester Stallone was only a couple of paragraphs, and a sleazier person would have made that the focal point of the book.
But are you saying that you missed the Paris Hilton reference?
Oh, yeah, I saw that one, too.
The Kinkajou that bit her, keeping the Kinkajou illegally in Los Angeles.
Yeah. Now, this woman in Connecticut, who had a monkey, right?
Or a chimpanzee.
Chimpanzee, who she had really anthropomorphized.
No question.
And was serving him wine from stemware.
Indeed. Do you want to drink your wine out of a water glass?
I have. And this really gets into a zone where you have to wonder about the balance of an individual who becomes so connected and really intimate with a wild animal of this type that she really seems to lose a reference point to good judgment.
Well, we have to look a little bit under the veneer here and also make some definitions. A wild animal, but there are two categories here. Now, a chimpanzee is an endangered species, and you can't legally import one from the wilds into this country and have it as a pet. That violates international treaties and United States law. But a captive bred chimpanzee can be traded. And this chimpanzee was, in fact, bought from a breeder, and I visited that breeder in Missouri. So what's the difference between these animals? What is a captive bred chimpanzee versus a wild chimpanzee? Is a captive bred chimpanzee that has been around people all its life and brought up by people and brought up essentially to be a pet, is that an object that's appropriate for a pet? Well, I learned not post-adolescence, that's for sure. Then there is the woman herself. She had recently lost her husband. He died. She'd recently lost her daughter, I believe it was, but the only child died. Mm-hmm. And this chimpanzee, she self-describes as essentially her family and her child. The house has on the refrigerator, just like you may well have had the drawings of your son up on the refrigerator door, the drawings of Travis the chimpanzee were mm-hmm. up on the refrigerator door. And the list goes on right to the lying in bed drinking the wine from stemware, and I'm rolling my eyes on the radio here, and then spending the night sleeping with right. the chimpanzee. Of course, that conjures up all kinds of images. Was there a sexual relationship there? There's nothing to suggest that, but mm-hmm. there are those of us who have had wine from stem glasses and then spent the night with somebody with whom they drank that wine, and there were sexual relations.
Or in Roxanne Gillespie's case, apparently a trumpet.
and that's probably another book, and you can write that one, Peter.
So who were some of the people who you met along this odyssey who really impressed you with an appropriate commitment to the well-being of these animals, but still retained a kind of human interest and the kind of affectionate bond that is appropriate?
Well, my poster children live in Pahrump, Nevada, and they are Susanna Kukul and Scott Shoemaker. And if they are listening, Susanna and Scott, I'm not saying positive things about you just because you sent me so many emails saying that you'd heard me on the radio and why didn't I talk about the other side of the story. They are the other side of the story, I think, in many respects. They do not hide the fact that they like exotic pets. In their case, it's tigers and a lion, Bam Bam the lion. And they live outside of Pahrump. If you've been to that part of Nevada, it's about an hour from Las Vegas, and it's the Wild West still. They don't bother their neighbors because basically there aren't any neighbors. Mm-hmm. They have enclosures that would keep these cats from getting out, undoubtedly, so that there wouldn't be a problem for the community, and they've never been out. They, by my observations, treat them well and enjoy the interaction that they have with them.
Mm-hmm.
Is that okay? Well, it's legal. And as Susanna Kukul likes to say, she's an immigrant from Slovakia. This is America. Don't tell me what to do. And these are my property.
You captured her accent quite well.
You know, thank you.
Yeah, without being mean or anything.
No, she's a delightful woman. Mm-hmm. And I count the two of them as friends. One of the things that's happened, Peter, with both of these books and now with the third one is I'm meeting people and getting to know them and collecting friends along the way mm-hmm. on all sides of this issue, which is fun.
Yeah. Now, you also, in several places, present the views of people for the ethical treatment of animals. And I'm one of those people who's ambivalent about them because I feel that they do go too far and they often do interfere in an inappropriate way. That said, I think they help set an appropriate standard for people to at least be aware of and to be conscious. And that consciousness, I think, is something that's very valuable that PETA has provided. But some of their public histrionics seem to go a little too far. And I tend to recoil a little bit at what I consider to be their extremism.
Well, you're going to ask a question I know in a minute, but you made me think about Tom Tancredo, who was the congressman for a long time from Colorado, who was on the ultimate fringe of the immigration debate mm-hmm. in terms of keep them out of here. And I had an intriguing interview on one of my radio shows with him where he said he felt that this was his role was to really push hard from the extreme, and that maybe that would result in there being some movement in the immigration debate that would result in the reform that people on all sides of it agree needs to occur.
And you've written about that, by the way.
And I have written about it. Mm-hmm. And I think PETA performs, the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, performs the same kind of a role. So that kind of fringe work is probably an important element of our society, as long as it doesn't go to the next extreme. I just came back from Denver, where I interviewed a guy for this third book who has right here across his neck, mm-hmm. and he's clean-shaven, unlike the neck I'm showing you here on the radio, and vegan is tattooed there, and mm-hmm. and we'll talk about that, I hope, when that book comes out. But he's locked up because he's charged with arson, burning down a leather factory, a sheep skin factory, mm-hmm. and a restaurant that serves foie gras. Mm-hmm. So that, I cannot find any sympathy for those kinds of actions, and I don't think that they're valuable for our political process. But I think PETA, even though I agree with you, I disagree with a lot of their tactics, I think mm-hmm. they're an important part of the overall process here.
Well, and I hasten to add that we've had an extreme overreaction in the form of federal legislation that creates a new category of crime for people who commit protest actions in the name of animals. And this is particularly aimed at protecting laboratories that use animals for experiments. And I really can't abide by this domestic terrorism, and there's I can't remember the language of the bill, but it basically says that if you conduct some sort of, if you commit a crime, vandalism, breaking and entering, or something related to that, because of your philosophy about animals, that warrants a much a stiffer sentence than if you had broken in to steal money or, you know, secrets or something like that. And it's interesting because Maxine Waters, the congresswoman who's now facing ethics charges, a couple of years ago stunned me because in an interview I asked her about that bill and noted that she had voted for it. And she said, you know what? I blew it.
Yeah,
well, I was wrong about that, and I figured it out later. And I said, wait a minute, Congresswoman, what did you just say?
Yeah, well, that's an example of those who tend right now to be on the right-wing side but are saying, read the bill, and it's probably a good idea. It's a bipartisan position.
Yeah.
Read the bill.
Yeah. So in dealing with these various individuals and groups, you tend to be very forward and explain your own point of view. As I mentioned, you're a vegan. You have a pet cat now. You had a beloved pet dog named Amigo that you memorialize in the book. And so how do you navigate the personal politics of these very disparate people that you talk with?
Oh, I think that that's easy. And I think that one, it's impossible to be objective, and it's silly to say I'm an objective reporter. Mm-hmm. We can seek clarity and accuracy and fairness. And in the context of a book like this, where I am, as you say, on a quest, I'm trying to get an understanding of why people keep these so-called pets and what that means to the culture and to the environment and to the society, then I'm learning along the way. And as I learn something about myself or about the issue and how I feel about it, I think that it brings out more of the character of the person I'm interviewing if I am not just asking them for their talking points, but mm-hmm. instead am engaging them in a conversation to help me figure this out. And consequently, I have to express my proclivities and my prejudices.
Mm-hmm. So, Burmese pythons.
For example.
In the Everglades.
Right.
This is a fascinating story, and at first, I was reminded of a movie I've chosen to never see called Snakes on a Plane.
I cite that movie in the book.
That's all I need. And I saw the Lawrence Fishburne trailer, and that's fine. But it's fascinating because a wave of hysteria has been created about a population of unknown numbers of pythons that are believed to have been released by human captors into the Everglades and other parklands in Florida. And as you talk to people who have been authorized to go out and kill them, and then you talk to others, the scientists, who say, well, wait a minute, we don't even know how many there are, and there hasn't been a reported incident of one of these released snakes attacking a human, has there?
No, there are reported incidents of snakes kept as pets that get out and attack humans, and there's a tragic story that I cite that has helped to raise consciousness about the Burmese python in Florida. A fellow was living with his girlfriend, and the girlfriend's daughter was smothered to death by his pet python, who he had not properly kept the python constrained in the tank.
Mm-hmm. And so is this just the kind of stuff that leads a 11 o'clock newscast on television? I mean, I remember when the killer bees were moving northward, and we would routinely get warned on, you know, these cheesy newscasts on television. Killer bees! They're 300 miles closer than they were a year ago!
Yeah, or a few years ago, there were sharks from Miami to Kennebunkport that were going to get you if you went swimming that summer.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't seem to be the case here. I spent a lot of time with the chief biologist at the Everglades National Park in charge of this project, and he's a pretty level-headed guy. And there are a lot of these snakes in the Everglades and throughout Florida, and it's probably not going to be a problem for you if you are a tourist. But what it's a problem for are protected endangered species in the park and throughout Florida, because this is an apex predator that likes to eat,
mm-hmm.
really likes to eat.
Yeah.
And once the snake is just a little bit past a hatchling, pretty much nobody's going to go after the snake except for a confused alligator or a really hungry alligator.
Mm-hmm.
And consequently, these snakes are eating populations that have been protected, and there isn't a practical way to protect them against the snake if the snake continues to flourish. It's in an environment very similar to its Southeast Asian home. Not much is known about it, but there are a few things that help to add to the hysteria, if you'd like to promulgate that. A mama can host 50, 60 eggs at a go-round, and they may well all flourish after they hatch. Nobody's going to bother that pile of eggs much when she's protecting it.
Mm-hmm.
And it appears, and again, this is an aspect of this which is fascinating, not much is known because even in their home range, there hasn't been much study on this animal. It appears that she only needs to have an encounter once with a male, and she can then store that which makes her eggs fertile.
Mm-hmm.
And the potential there for a lot of snakes is quite phenomenal. And one other thing, you said that they seem to be there because people bought them as pets and let them loose in the Everglades when they got to be 200 pounds and 24 feet and really messy eaters, or not necessarily messy eaters, but after mm-hmm. they eat, they make a mess of the cage, and they eat a lot, costs a lot to keep them. That seems to be true, but there are also those who say that this is the result of Hurricane Andrew and destroyed pet stores and destroyed scientific institutions that were holding these animals for study, and they got out that way.
Mm-hmm. Peter, in the book, you recap the status of regulation. Let me just read a little bit here. American laws regarding the keeping of exotic animals are mixed. Federal authorities regulate imports and protect migratory birds and animals covered by the Endangered Species Act. The act also addresses the keeping of exotic animals for exhibition, entertainment, and breeding. State and local laws oversee pet exotic animals not considered endangered and vary from zero restrictions to the opposite extreme. The nuances are complex. A tiger born in the wilds of Asia is endangered and protected, while one captive bred in Texas for a pet can be bought and resold in the Lone Star State as if it were a common house cat. Some local communities have drafted precise, restrictive laws that limit and control the types of animals their citizens can keep. In other locales, it's a Wild West mentality, and you can unload Noah's Ark on your private property. So that makes for a very difficult effort. We don't even know how many critters there are in how many places.
Or where they are. Because that's, there's no census.
Yeah.
And that's just those who are obeying this complex overlay of laws. And, of course, human nature is such, not to mention the profit motive and lust for the exotic, that there are plenty of people who are keeping these pets in violation of the law or trafficking in them mm-hmm. and transporting them.
And in particular, the idea of using animals for human entertainment and for commercial purposes, like TV commercials or X-rated movies where exotic animals are used to, you know, create an interest or a sexual scene.
You are definitely watching things that aren't on at my house.
So there are some regulations about the use of animals in a commercial manner, right?
There are regulations in terms of how they can get to that set. What goes on the set would fall under the ordinances that would be local regarding animal cruelty. So if there is no perceived cruelty, then as long as how the animal got into this country and how it was transported, as long as those rules aren't violated, then you're fine with having J. Fred Muggs next to Dave Garraway mm-hmm. on the Today Show, saving it from being a ratings failure and leading to Matt, whatever his name is,
Lauer.
Having a successful career today.
Yeah, yeah. And are there ways, for example, we've seen that in order to avoid the expense of union actors and crews in Hollywood, that movie producers will go to Australia or Canada, Vancouver, or even Detroit to cut their costs. Are there ways that people skirt the regulations related to performance animals by going to jurisdictions where there's no jurisdiction?
That you got me with that one. I don't know the answer to that. I imagine so, but I simply don't know. I'll poke mm-hmm. around on that for the third book, yeah.
Now, one thing that I didn't see in your book and I'm curious about is that you don't talk about circuses and you don't talk about some of these theme parks, Marine World and its imitators, that feature animals as a prime attraction. What was your thinking there?
Well, I'm trying to focus on this book, the Forbidden Creatures book, on the exotic pet world. And in fact, I know I shouldn't be talking too much about a book that's not out yet and won't be out for a year, but I just came back from Budapest and was with this incredible guy from the Ukraine who is a self-taught lion tamer and watched him perform with his seven lions in the ring and watched him put his head in the mouth of one of the lions. So I am meddling in that world mm-hmm. in this next book and also deal with the park that's right up the street here in Vallejo. It keeps changing its name.
It was Marine World. It's a Six Flags something or
right.
other now.
And yeah. I went there years ago when my youngest son was much younger. Since it was years ago, he was obviously mm-hmm. much younger. And went to a display of the killer whales and put mm-hmm. that into the context of the woman who was killed just recently in Florida at another park. Name escapes me now. And so I deal with that in this third book. I tried mm-hmm. The world of animals is obviously fascinating. As a business, the numbers are enormous. It's one of these. When you mentioned that I've done some work on border issues, everybody has a position on immigration and on the border. And everybody agrees that the border with Mexico is dysfunctional. That makes for a fascinating issue. If you want to talk about orange juice, there are probably a lot of people that really don't have much of an opinion about orange juice. So with animals, it's the same thing. Everybody is engaged somehow in some way with animals. And as I'm writing these three books, I'm trying to maintain a focus so that I have a storyline. Butterflies, mm-hmm. the exotic, and then where is it when we start to abuse them?
Mm-hmm. The Midwest United States seems to be a hotbed for the trading of exotic animals. You attended an auction in Missouri. Is there a reason for that?
Not one that I can pinpoint yet, but you're absolutely right. Your old home state of Ohio is pretty much wide open. So is Indiana. And Missouri is unbelievable. There are attempts being made at making changes in those states, but you can do pretty much anything you want. Texas also, so it's not a Midwest phenomenon. Mm-hmm. And Wisconsin's wild. From the coastal prejudicial perspective, you know, it's those flyover states. I don't know what they're doing. But I grew up in Wisconsin and you in Ohio, and we know that's not so. And why that has happened the way it's happened, I'm not sure. But there certainly are efforts in Missouri, where I spent a lot of time researching this book, by people who don't want to change that because they do have a beachhead there, and somebody like Connie Casey, who breeds chimpanzees, including Travis, the one that went amok in Connecticut, mm-hmm. certainly does not want her business restricted.
What is the appeal of the serval? You describe that as kind of a hot property these days.
Well, I never heard of it prior to researching this.
So describe one.
Serval
looks a little ball
like you. No. The one I held was a little ball. As I said, the fur is softer than your new little dog over there sitting on the floor here in the studio. They are house cat-like looking, although not like most common house cats. There's a rounder face, and they get to be at a midpoint. They're the smallest, if I'm remembering correctly, of what are known as the big cats, and they will stand up maybe 3 feet, and that's hefty for mm-hmm. a house cat, mm-hmm. and it is a wild cat, and the appeal may be because it's perceived that if you raise it from a pup, I know that's the wrong term, and it learns how to love you and bond with you, then you'll be able to have it in your house like a house cat, but still very strange because it's so much bigger and it won't tear the place up or tear you up. Mm-hmm. And that may be so, and it may not be so, because as is always the case, it's an unknown.
Yeah. Well, and the common thread here is that the owners think that they and their particular animal are exceptional. And in particular, the theme throughout is that as these animals age, that's when they lose their puppiness.
Yes, they're not so cuddly when they are adolescent and post-adolescent.
Mm-hmm. And that sense of exceptionalism really permeates their thinking. Did you have any reflection on that as to...
aren't we arrogant, egoistic to think that, well, this is how it's been through the ages, but for me, it's going to be different. It's going to love me because I am nurturing it from the beginning, bottle feeding it, teaching it that I'm its mother. Well, you're not its mother. That's ridiculous. And that's one of the reasons I like Susanna Kukul and Scott Shoemaker's attitude so much, because, for example, when she went into the enclosure with Bam Bam, the lion, mm-hmm. that they estimate weighs about 500 pounds. They don't have a scale that is adequate for weighing Bam Bam. She said, okay, I'm going in. I've got this brush that I can whack him on the nose with, but I also have this pepper spray in case that doesn't work. And she went in, and there was no problem. She went in and pet him and brushed him a little bit, didn't have to whack him on the nose, and certainly didn't have to take out the pepper spray. But she knows that no matter how much Bam Bam may like her, he may also swat her and kill mm-hmm. her. And for her, I'm quite convinced, and Susanna will, I know, correct me if I'm wrong here, I'm quite convinced that part of the enjoyment, she genuinely likes Bam Bam, but part of the enjoyment is that she's treading with an unknown potential danger and a potentially life-threatening situation.
But nobody really mentioned adrenaline. Nobody mentioned a rush that I recall.
Yeah.
And one would expect that, you know, after risking a little and coming out unscathed, that there would be either a rush or a feeling of relief that would be expressed. And I don't recall seeing that.
Well, maybe it's because these people are not victims. They've had positive experiences with these animals so far. And so consequently, it hasn't reached that proportion. I tell you, the guy that I spoke with in Hungary told me that, I said, how does it feel when you stick your head in that lion's mouth? And he said exactly what you just talked about. He said, I just want it to be over with as fast as possible each time.
Mm.
And he absolutely said it was adrenaline. But he's in a different relationship. They are working for him, and they are performing the Seven Lions and the Tamer. Whereas Bam Bam is, all 500 pounds of him, and potentially just as dangerous, is the pet of Tsutsana and Scott. They are not performing with him, and Bam Bam lives in Parumph.
Yeah. Well, and as you're describing that, I'm thinking of Roy, of Siegfried and Roy. Roy, right. Lichten?
I always forget his last name, yeah. But he's the guy that, and this was in front of a live audience in Las Vegas, and this was a tiger that he had raised from a pup. And the story is that from their side, from the tamer's side, that the chain got tangled somehow and disturbed the tiger, and so he lashed out to try to fix that, or because it was a discomfort, and that resulted in Roy almost dying.
Yeah. Similar story in Florida with a tiger or critter on the set of a rap video.
Yes, indeed. And this was
Mark,
the rapper. I don't remember the rapper's name.
The trainer. I think his name was Mark something. But
And he brought this tiger to the set, and it was the same kind of a thing, that the chain got entangled, and the show went on in that case. And then PETA, the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, got involved, and to his disgust, the trainer, and he is just wild in his assault on PETA and its type, and just
did he show you the wound? Because it sounded like the animal got a pretty good bite on his leg.
Yeah, he was healed, and I didn't see a scar. Yeah. But that led me directly to go up to PETA's headquarters in Washington. And you were speaking earlier, Peter, about the fringe nature of the organization. And it was exemplified for me when I was sitting with the executive director and the founder, and she pointed to a couple of sparrows that were on the fire escape of this gorgeous headquarters building that they have a couple of blocks north of the Capitol on K Street in Washington. They are an extremely...
Where all the lobbies are, sure.
Well, where all the lobbies are, and they are extremely well-funded operation.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, that's what it should be like. Those birds on the fire escape do whatever they want to do. And then she had a bit of a double take, and she said, but I shouldn't have put those corn chips out there, because that's not their natural bird food.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah. Well, she was very gracious, and I very much appreciate the opportunity to meet with her, and she's a little precious.
Mm-hmm. Ingrid Newkirk?
Yes.
Is that right? Yeah,
yes.
I've spoken with her once,
yes.
I recall. And she's smart, and...
Oh, yes.
She seems to be more politically adroit than some of the people who follow. And I do understand that it's not a top-down organization where she's in charge of these activists. But she comes across as thoughtful and strategic in the way she operates the organization.
No question.
Mm-hmm. So, Peter, did you have any moments where you thought you were in trouble, where you thought you were going to get bitten or lunged at by one of these critters?
Well, I had one opportunity when one of the pythons that I was being shown by the biologist at the Everglades started to wrap around his arm, and it seemed that I was going to have to unwrap that python, and then he managed to to pull his arm out, and in some ways I was disappointed that I would not have been able to save the chief biologist in charge of Python study for the United States government, but on the other hand, I was happy to not have to grab the slimy thing who was busy excreting some kind of foul something out of itself while he was or she was wrapping around his self. So that's about as close as I got to danger. But when I was at the chimpanzee breeding place of Connie Casey, Chimp Party, it's called, because she also hires these out if you want to have a party and have a chimpanzee, although she must not be able to do that anymore except for the one that's still cuddly. I didn't ask her about that because that was not the orientation of my questioning there. But there was one guy in particular, Connor. They all have names. And Connor is a bruiser. He's got to be 200 pounds, I would think. And the measurement of muscle of adult chimpanzees is that pound for pound, they're going to be 4 to 7 times stronger than a 200-pound man is going to be. So here's Connor, and he is going around this enclosure that he's in at the place in Missouri, and every time he goes around, there's a glass front wall. We're looking at him, he's looking at us, and then there are the other three walls. And he walks around as he gets to the first wall, the back wall, and when he gets to the third wall, like that, he's slamming his forearm in what I perceive to be frustration, anger against it. And then he climbs up on his trapeze, and he starts to swing, and then hurls himself front forward against these laminated three layers of quarter-inch glass, tempered glass, that he just slams against it, and it holds. And then, just as an indicator of how sad I found this whole thing, he gets on his haunches and starts to suck his thumb. Mm. But if he had broken that glass, which I imagine that was his intent, and got outside with us, I don't think what he wanted to do was give me a hug and a kiss.
Now, if we can examine the characterization you just made, don't you, to some extent, impute feelings to animals based on the behavior that you observe that is anthropomorphic in its own way?
Well, what the heck do I know for certain about what the chimpanzee is thinking? But the chimpanzee is the closest to us, and I don't know for certain, but it was a very unnerving experience being there. And there was another one, Kimmy, who was, again, on the other side of an enclosure, because all she has a couple of dozen or so. She didn't have many rules that she requested me to follow in exchange for the opportunity to tour the place and interview her, but one was that she didn't want me to relate the exact number of chimpanzees that she has at the place because she thought that that could further reflect poorly on her because the number is large. And Kimmy, I'm just realizing that, but without citing a number, I did exactly what she didn't want me to do. And Kimmy, on the other side of the glass there, was frantic, and she looked threadbare and tawdry and tired and unhappy. Yes, anthropomorphizing there. And she's engaged in this sign language. And Connie Casey, who was a very gracious host, and I very much appreciate her giving me the opportunity to tour the place and get to know her, because it helps me understand this better, I think, and then consequently tell you and others through the book and opportunities to talk like this. Kimmy is engaged in this sign language that Connie Casey is saying is meaningless to anyone else. I think that that suggests frustration, no matter the animal, without really anthropomorphizing. I'm watching this. She's frantically engaged in what is a sign language that only she knows. And then looking up, you've got this dog, you've only had this dog for a couple of weeks. You're already getting some sense, at least, of when you think this dog is happy or sad, hungry or tired, thirsty, annoyed.
Still trying to pick up when she needs to pee, but
work on that, please, because we don't want the studio messed up. I'm coming back here. And so when something as close to us as a chimpanzee is looking up at me, at you, I think it's safe to be able to say something like, with forlorn eyes.
Yeah. Finally, Peter, I'm a little concerned about Schrodinger. Schrodinger or Schrodinger?
Schrodinger.
Schrodinger. This is your cat who is semi-wild. You describe how he can come and go from your house through the cat door, that sometimes he comes back groomed or fed, and that the community is picking up your slack. And you're about to uproot him and take him 400 miles north.
Hey, it's just a cat. Funny you should say that, Sheila. My wife was just on the phone as I was crossing the Golden Gate Bridge, and she said, I've talked to the airlines. It's really problematic about shipping him without us on the plane. He hates to ride in a cat box in the car, And I said, baby, don't worry about it. I'll take care of it. And she said, you will, huh? And I said, yeah, just don't worry about it, because moving is so stressful, as you know, Peter. And so I solicit from you and your world of listeners any ideas on how to make this transition, not just the actual move, mm-hmm. but then how to take this cat who's no kitten anymore and has established himself in Bodega Bay and has lived there all his life, and he's suddenly going to be in Eugene and somewhat corralled. Help me.
I think you should get him accustomed to coffee and Birkenstocks.
There is a show at the museum in Eugene right now, which is titled Tie-Dye and Tofu, and it's a retrospective of the last 40 or so years, how it is that Eugene went from a typical Oregon town to what somebody in Denver referred to me as Boulder on steroids.
Mm-hmm. Well, listeners, pipe up. Send an email to peter@peterbcollins.com or what's your favorite, peter@peterlaufer.com?
peterlaufer@peterlaufer.com.
Okay, L-A-U-F-E-R.
Love to hear from you, peterlaufer@peterlaufer.com, and I very much appreciate the opportunity to talk about the book with you, Peter.
The book is Forbidden Creatures, Inside the World of Animal Smuggling and Exotic Pets, and we've been talking with Peter Laufer, and it's fascinating, it's interesting. And if you have any connection to animals, you definitely should read it. And good luck to you in your new venture in Eugene, Oregon, and the transition with Schrodinger.
Thank you so much, Peter, and you'll be up there guest lecturing.
Looking forward to it.
Bonjour, this is Véronique Raskin. I am the CEO of the Organic Wine Company, and I want to personally invite you to join the Peter B. Monthly Organic Wine Club. Call me for the details, and I do answer my phone, at 1-888-ECO-WINE. Or visit us at www.theorganicwinecompany.com. À bientôt, j'espère. Merci.
Hey, thanks for listening to the Peter B. Collins Show. And why don't you spread the word, tell a friend, or email 10 people right now and give them the link to peterbcollins.com. Now the second installment of what we hope will be a regular series of commentaries, or shall we say rants, from political comedian and satirist Will Durst.
Hey guys, Will Durst here to talk about Chief U.S. District Judge Vaughn Walker's overturn of California's Proposition 8, the one that banned same-sex marriages. Get that? He overturned the ban, loosed the bonds, broke the chains, greased the skids, and raised the rainbow flag. According to his radical ruling, restricting freedoms is wrong. Hence, gay marriage is okay. The 136-page opinion finds that keeping two people from being happy because of religious convictions violates the U.S. Constitution. Apparently the message is, if you don't believe people should marry someone of the same sex, then go right ahead and don't marry someone of the same sex. But if you don't believe that other people should be able to marry someone of the same sex, tough titty. You can't stand in the way of other people's happiness simply because you don't get it or like it. Your personal beliefs have nothing to do with how your neighbors get to live their lives. You don't want the Taliban telling your wife she has to dress like a beekeeper now, do you? And this ruling did not come from a flaming liberal. The judge was appointed by Ronald Reagan, so you could say that according to Reagan, gay marriage is okay. Of course, this is not over by a long shot. The forces of repression are already frothing like rabid dogs in a soap factory, trying to make sure that everybody lives exactly like them. And at least two courts are expected to weigh in as soon as they get their robes laundered. Then again, I always thought that the whole idea was to keep gays from having sex. What better way than marriage, do you know? You're a witness, Mr. Berger. For the Peter B. Collins Show, I'm Will Durst.
Thanks for listening to this edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Your feedback is welcome. Email me, peter@peterbcollins.com. Happy trails.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.